This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran begins 10-day celebrations to mark the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian following an alleged knife attack near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem. And supporters of prominent Nigerian Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki stage a rally in the city of Bauchi to call for his immediate release. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. January 31st marks the start of 10-day celebrations that commemorates the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Every year, people commemorate the occasion by holding ceremonies and events nationwide. This year, too, people are remembering that event. On February the 1st, 1979, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, returned home from exile. He led the people's struggle against the tyranny of the time. The revolution eventually emerged victorious on February the 1st, the same year, putting an end to the dictatorial rule of the Pahlavi regime. The incumbent president of Iran must leave office almost after 6 months when his second term comes to an end. People will go to the polls in June to elect a new president. The situation this time, though, is a little different, as the coronavirus pandemic has not disappeared yet, and the country will perhaps struggle against the virus during the campaign and on election day. Human Abedi reports.
Iran will reach top news headlines in 2021 as the country is slated to hold its 13th presidential elections in mid-June. This as the world is still gripped by the pandemic and the COVID-19 death tolls are continuing to rise despite the development of a vaccine. After the disputed U.S. presidential election, now all the eyes would be on Iran's polls. It will be one of the most unique polls in the country's new century, as observers say it is the most influential and essential country in the region, and its future elections can generate significant events in the region and the world. We attended a presser by the head of the country's election commission to see how the polls would be held amid the coronavirus pandemic.
In our latest discussions with the Guardian Council, we reached the conclusion that it is not possible to hold postal voting or install electronic ballot boxes, but the procedures before and after the voting would sure be electronic to avoid the virus threats.
The top Interior Ministry official also noted that they are doing their best not to let the gatherings and campaigns be held physically, and instead the people could get to know the plans of the candidates on the mass media. Or said that in the first step, those wishing to nominate for the race would probably register via mobile application and then be invited to the headquarters to finalize their registration process to avoid gatherings. We asked the Deputy Interior Minister about the possibility of holding the polls in more than a single day or increasing the number of polling stations amid the pandemic.
We will surely use the experience of the other countries in holding elections during a pandemic. Up to now, there is no decision to hold polls in several days, but we will certainly increase the number of polling stations by thousands to observe health protocols carefully.
He also added that some special facilities would be considered for those infected with the coronavirus as well. Up to now, only the former defense minister Hossein Dehghan has confirmed his bid for the top political office. Besides Dehghan, the names of many other former officials have come up as potential candidates. Iran's 13th presidential election is slated to be held on June 18th, and people would go to the polls to choose the country's 8th president. The 6th local council's elections would also be held on the same day. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem. The army said that a Palestinian died of his wounds after the troops shot him at close range at a bus stop in the Gush Etzion area. The army claimed that a man was trying to stab the troops. Israeli soldiers frequently shoot the Palestinians, citing similar allegations across the occupied territories. Gush Etzion has been a flashpoint of such attacks. On the 5th of January, Israeli soldiers shot dead another Palestinian in the same area. Israeli people have held a fresh rally against Prime Minister Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Guts. They gather outside his residence to condemn his policies and ask for his resignation. The demonstration was held despite a ban. Israelis have staged rallies over the past months to protest rising unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and return of restrictions. On top of the anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu was tried in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. An explosion has rocked the Turkish-occupied city in Syria's northern province of Aleppo, killing 6 civilians, including 3 children. The deadly incident occurred when an explosive-laden vehicle went off near the base of Turkish-affiliated militants in the city of Afrin. More than 2 dozen civilians were also wounded in that explosion. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the death toll could rise. Afrin and other Turkish-occupied areas in northern Syria are regularly hit by such bombings. In January 2018, Ankara launched a cross-border military operation inside Syria with a declared aim of driving the Syrian Kurdish militants out of Afrin. The Political Bureau of Ansar Allah and the Anti-Aggression Party bloc have held an intellectual and political symposium at the event to discuss American crimes in Yemen and their legal and humanitarian dimensions. Our correspondent in Sana'a has more.
American crimes in Yemen are still the most pressing topic for discussion in Yemen. The Ansar Allah Political Bureau and the Anti-Aggression Party bloc held an intellectual and political symposium to discuss U.S. crimes in Yemen.
We are holding this symposium under the title of American Terrorism in Yemen, a terrorism that continues for the 6th year, during which all kinds of crimes were committed against the Yemeni people, including killing, destruction, and siege that had a negative impact on all aspects of life and the humanitarian situation. In this event, we highlight the crimes that were monitored during the war on Yemen.
The participants affirmed that America is a key partner in the war on Yemen with the military and logistical support of the Saudi-led coalition, and it is also behind the support of terrorist groups such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda, not only in Yemen but in the region.
The American regime, with all its administrations, is a creator and supporter of armed groups and terrorist organizations, not only in the region, but throughout the world, even in Nigeria, the Philippines, and Indonesia. So we consider terrorism in all its forms an American product.
Washington designated the Ansarullah movement a terrorist organization after 6 years of armed sales to the Saudi-led coalition, which killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions.
After it has established and sent terrorist groups to the Arab region, the U.S. still stands accused of providing financial and military support to these groups in violation of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Nigerians have held a protest rally in the city of Bauchi to call for the immediate release of prominent Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife. The event was organized by members and supporters of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. Protesters held pictures of the cleric and chanted slogans as they walked through Bauchi's streets. They argued that armed terrorists and the Nigerian government are the two sides of the same coin. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife have been jailed since the Nigerian army attacked their residence in the northern city of Zaria. Hundreds of the Sheikh's supporters were killed and many others got arrested during the army raid in 2015. Germany has threatened to take legal action against pharmaceutical companies that fail to deliver coronavirus vaccines to the European Union on schedule. Economy Minister Peter Altmaier also warned that no company can favor another country over the EU. This after the announcement by the British-Swedish firm AstraZeneca that it can only deliver a quarter of the vaccines promised to the EU in the first quarter of the year. The company says this is due to problems at its labs in Belgium. It also says that vaccines produced in its Britain-based laboratories would be exclusively distributed in the UK. Brussels has implicitly accused AstraZeneca of giving preferential treatment to Britain at the expense of the European Union. Rome has permanently stopped arms export to Riyadh and the UAE amid concerns over the two Arab countries' continued war crimes in Yemen. Max Civili has a report.
Italy's government's decision to block exports of arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates over the ongoing bloodshed in Yemen has been hailed by activists and several Italian lawmakers. The move comes after 2 years of parliamentary activity and lobbying by humanitarian organizations. In 2018, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte indicated his government's intention to end arms sales to Riyadh over its involvement in the onslaught on Yemen and the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Let me start by saying that this is a historic achievement. I and Ms. Quartapelle were the first signatories of a resolution that has permanently revoked approval for arms exports to Saudi Arabia and UAE. This is a clear message of peace coming from our country.
The government did the right thing, even though its decision will affect about 200 workers from a German factory located in a depressed Italian region. The German weapons maker is to sue our country over the decision to stop all arms exports to Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, a blockade should have been already imposed long ago.
The government's decision will halt the sale of almost 13,000 Italian-made missiles to Saudi Arabia. The blocked sales were part of total export of 20,000 missiles worth over 400 million euros agreed in 2016 under the government headed by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Renzi is currently facing criticism for participating in Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiative conference and holding a conversation with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, during which he described the prince as his friend. He has said the monarchy could be the place of a new renaissance for the future.
Matteo Renzi's reputation in politics is one of ruthlessness. In 2014, he pledged then Prime Minister and fellow party member Enrico Letta that he wouldn't anyhow hinder the government, only to shortly afterward orchestrate Letta's downfall. Renzi then became Prime Minister himself. About 2 weeks ago, Renzi triggered the government crisis by abruptly pulling his small Italia Viva party out of the ruling coalition.
According to Italian media, Renzi earns $80,000 a year as a member of Saudi Arabia's Future Investment Initiative's advisory board. Max Civili, Rome.
Let's take a look at the coronavirus situation. The number of confirmed cases in the U.S. has surpassed the 26 million mark. According to Johns Hopkins University, 438,000 Americans have also died of the virus. The first months of 2021 has been the country's deadliest since the beginning of the pandemic, nearly 91,000 fatalities there. The U.S., the world's worst country by the pandemic, is struggling to contain the spread of new strains of the novel coronavirus. Maryland has become the second U.S. state to report a more transmissible variant first identified in South Africa. On Thursday, South Carolina also reported two cases of the strain. Now that as wearing masks and conveyances has been mandated from February the 1st by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Veronica Ravello says that the surge in COVID-19 infections in the United States mainly has to do with the government's mishandling of the pandemic.
We had the 26 million cases so far. But it's very interesting to understand how the first 13 million happened. It took 365 days, a year, for the first 13 million. But for the second 13 million people, it was just 64 days. So it's narrowing. So the number increases dramatically. Brazil and United States, or United States and Brazil, they have the same problem. And basically, you have the same behavior of the government. So they are not accepting the virus. They are in denial of the virus. They they asked people to take the different medication that was not approved by the scientists. So that at the beginning was the main cause. And then, of course, their followers was not obeying the mask, the distancing, keeping distance from each other, and not following the directions of the Minister of Health of those two countries that I mentioned, especially here in the United States.
A team of experts led by the World Health Organization tasked with investigating the origins of COVID-19 has visited a market in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The Huanan Seafood Market is the place where the first clusters of infections reportedly emerged more than a year ago. It's been sealed since January last year. The mission of the WHO team is to explore how the virus jumped from animal to humans. Experts have also visited several hospitals in that city. WHO officials have already downplayed expectations of finding the source of the deadly virus. The respiratory disease has killed more than 2 million people, infecting over 100 million globally. In Russia, police have made scores of arrests as people once again take to the streets across the country in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Authorities had already warned Navalny supporters against the staging of unauthorized rallies. Police cautioned that any provocative actions will be seen as a threat to public security and will be dealt with. The demonstrations came after an appeals court denied bail to Navalny. The opposition figure is facing 30 days in detention pending trial in early February on charges of violating parole. Navalny was arrested after returning home from Germany, where he had been recovering from alleged poisoning in Russia. Thousands of people were arrested in last weekend's rallies, which were called by Navalny following his detention. Several lawyers of former U.S. President Donald Trump have left his legal team more than a week before his second impeachment trial in the Senate. U.S. media says the lawyers include Butch Bowers and Deborah Barbier, who were expected to lead the defense. They said that Trump had wanted the lawyers to continue his claims of mass election fraud rather than focus on the legality of convicting a president after he left office. They added that he was not receptive to discussion. Trump's impeachment trial is set to begin on February 9th over charges of incitement of insurrection of the Capitol building. If convicted, he will be barred from holding any future public office. Nearly all senators from his party have signaled opposition to the trial. The UK is opening a special visa route for the residents of Hong Kong to British citizenship. The new scheme enables Hong Kongers with a British National Overseas Passport to apply online for visa to live and work in the UK. After 5 years, they can apply for citizenship. Britain says the offer is a response to China's security law introduced last year for the semi-autonomous city, which was once a British colony. China has reacted with fury, saying it will no longer recognize British national overseas passports valid as of today. Beijing also says it's prepared to take further measures against London's move. China has warned that a visa scheme would damage bilateral ties and further hurt Britain's own long-term interests. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who is from India,
listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, January 31st, 2021. I'm Ata Fairfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are read through emails and letters. So contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Or if you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice and send it to us and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special, the Sunday program, is your program. It's your views that are important for us. And heartiest congratulations to all our dear listeners. We are marking the 10-day dawn that 42 years ago ended domestic despotism and foreign hegemony in Iran. The 10-day dawn marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. 12 of Bahman, corresponding to February 1st, 1979, was the day on which the beloved leader of the Iranian people, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, returned home from exile and accelerated the struggles against the remnants of the Pahlavi regime. It was in 1979 that the sage of the age, Imam Khomeini, landed in Tehran to an unprecedented welcome seen anywhere in the world. Millions of Iranians from all walks of life thronged Mehrabad Airport to catch a glimpse of the return from almost 15 years of exile of the beloved leader. Over the past 40 years, the Islamic Republic of Iran has continued to cross milestone after milestone by making spectacular progress in all fields, despite the tyrannical sanctions imposed by the U.S. In other words, the sanctions are indeed a blessing in disguise. And the more the frustrated U.S. and its accomplices impose these worthless sanctions, the more determined and resolved our youths become in breaking new grounds in science and technology to the chagrin of Iranian enemies. The United States of America and the Zionist entity, the fake regime of Israel. Dear listeners of Listeners Special, please stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports enable us, actually, to provide a better service to our dear listeners throughout the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. However, as you may know, these days, with the outbreak of coronavirus around the world, please don't expect a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. As you may know, sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio is temporarily halted due to the pandemic, and that's because of the international hygienic protocols. So please be patient until the disease is controlled around the world, and then IRIB English Radio will get back on track and send you the paper QSL cards and other items as souvenirs of our radio. And here I truly appreciate those of our dear listeners who have sent us letters and emails from around the world, including David Faber from Switzerland. David has sent us an email. Adam Rowling from the UK has sent us an email. Also, we have an email from N.S. Bala Morali from India. And Lalit Kumar Kaga from India has also sent us an email. And the last but not the least is an email from Muhammad Tasli Uddin from Bangladesh. A million thanks to you, dear listeners. So after a short break, I will be back with all these letters and emails from around the world. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Here we have an email from India. This email is from Lalit Kumar Kaga. Lalit says, "Hello, I am your old listener. All of your programs are very good. And here, in our listeners club in India, we listen to your programs carefully. Please send us your New Year calendar, sticker, QSL card, and other promotional items if possible. Thank you in advance." Salam Lalit Kumar Kaga from India, and I do express my appreciation to you for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. Your satisfaction, and generally all our listeners' satisfaction of our broadcast, make us more resolved and determined in providing the best quality of programs in our radio. Anyway, you've requested IRIB English Radio souvenirs or items like calendar, sticker, QSL cards, and as I have said in the introduction of our programs, this is not possible, and this is temporary. After the coronavirus pandemic is eradicated and controlled around the world, we will get back on track, so be patient. We will send you QSL cards and souvenirs of our radio very soon in the future. Well, from the UK, we have an email from Adam Rowling. Adam Rowling says, "Dear friends at the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I am a shortwave radio listener from England and had a great pleasure of hearing your broadcast yesterday. I very much enjoyed your broadcast and found it interesting and informative. Some information about me. I'm 35 years old and live with my wife and two children in Cheshire, which is in the northwest of England. The closest city is Manchester, which is 30 miles away. I am a civil engineer and project manager. Thank you again for your excellent broadcast. I really enjoyed the very interesting content." Oh, well, salam, Adam Rowling from the UK. Greetings to you, and thank you very much for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. Adam, it seems that you've just joined us in IRIB English Radio. As you said, you had a chance to hear to IRIB English Radio broadcast, as you said, yesterday in your time. Well, it's also a pleasure to have you with us as a new listener, Adam. And we're so glad that you enjoyed our broadcast, as you noted that you found it interesting and informative. Adam, in your upcoming emails and letters, please tell us which programs you like the best. We wish you all the best. Write to us soon, Adam Rowling from the UK. Dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back. Here we have an email from Switzerland. This email is from David Faber. David says, here is a new report from Switzerland of your radio broadcast. Thank you for the quality of your programs. It changes our perception about Iran and what is represented to us by our corrupt European media. It's a pleasure to listen to you. Would it be possible to send me a QSL card? Thank you in advance and best regards. Salam and warm greetings to you, David Faber from Switzerland. We are so grateful for this email. It's also a pleasure to have you with us as a listener, as a new listener, actually. And we're so glad that you're satisfied with the quality of the programs in IRIB English Radio. And it seems that you enjoyed our programs. And as you said, the global arrogance, especially the U.S. and its allies, are trying to portray a false image of Iran and Iranian people. And this is through their media, as you said, their corrupt media. But Iran is a nation which has tried to change challenges into opportunities, you know, for all the time. And as you said, you found a true Iran, a true image of Iran through our programs and through our broadcast. What about traveling to Iran? It's a nice, I think it's a nice suggestion. Maybe you can find the true picture of Iran. Not only you, but many people can find the true image of Iran through traveling, through the Iranian media. Yes. Anyway, thank you very much for writing to IRIB English Radio. And as your request about sending a QSL card, as I've said, this is not possible for the time. And that's because of the coronavirus pandemic. This is because of the health and hygienic protocols. But as soon as the protocols are removed, we send our dear listeners around the world paper QSL cards and souvenirs of IRIB English Radio. Thank you again, David Faber from Switzerland. Write to us very soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon in the future. And from Bangladesh, we have an email from Muhammad Hasliuddin. Muhammad Hasliuddin says, I'm a regular listener of your radio station. Thank you for your cooperation and friendship. I send you my warmest greetings. I like your very nice culture. Thank you for your beautiful programs. The radio is my life. Please send me few items representing your radio. Stay safe in the time of coronavirus pandemic. Salam, Muhammad, and warmest greetings to you from Iran. And thanks a lot for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. And thank you for your compliments. It seems that you're satisfied with the programs. Anyway, many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. You also stay safe and healthy in the time of coronavirus pandemic. Keep in touch, Muhammad Hasliuddin from Bangladesh. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Muhammad Hasliuddin from Bangladesh. Well, dear listeners, what about a short break? Welcome back from India. We have an email from N.S. Balmurali. N.S. Balmurali says, dear staff, I'm writing to you after a long time. I hope you would be fine. I like your programs very much and your website too. And especially, I like your news analysis and photo galleries and videos. And I want your QSL card if possible. Thank you. Salam and greetings to you. N.S. Balmurali from India. Many thanks for sending us this email. And we're so grateful for your commitment to IRIB English Radio, as you said. You're writing to us after a long time, but you wrote this email after, as you said, a long period of time. Now that the coronavirus is gradually being controlled, we are wishing to very soon in the future send our dear listeners paper QSL cards and other promotional items of IRB English Radio. Thank you again for writing to us. N.S. Balmorali from India. Dear friend, please, in your upcoming emails, tell us which programs you like the best. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. N.S. Balmorali from India. And time tells me we have to skip to the next section of our program, and that is this week's interview. Please take a listen.
I'm from the UK, and I'm interested in radio and radio broadcast, and I have an interest in journalism as well as history and current affairs. Well, I enjoy activities like reading and traveling and music. These are my interests. I think they were very good, very professionally made. And I think for me, I think I learned a lot about my own country and my own society and politics in the West, which didn't allow me to learn anything about because it was so filtered and so controlled, and there was so much disinformation on the news media. You never really knew the truth. The RIB told me things, you know that were happening and why they happened in the USA and in the UK and in Western politics in general. So I think it's a valuable having an alternative view, which is a bit more creative and not so much censored by the corporations. Well, all I can say is keep enjoying listening to RIB, you know, because there's not many stations that give you such a wide, varied reporting service in terms of what is actually really happening in the world today in terms of politics, because all the Western media is controlled and filtered and sanitized and manipulated, you know, for their own ends, you know. So they don't want you to know the truth. But I think if you listen to RIB, you know, you start learning why things happen, and who's behind the news and all the different machinations of politics. So I think it's important, you know, so you can learn about politics and about culture.
Dear listeners, again, I congratulate you on the 10 days done, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. Here we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special Sunday program. Please keep in touch with IRB English Radio and have a good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RIB English Radio.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Although the new U.S. administration hasn't been in power for long, it has already shown that China is its target. Well, the Biden administration seems to be picking up where the Trump administration left off. However, with more of an aggressive military face towards Beijing, the U.S. says China is being aggressive with Taiwan flying military planes over the island. Beijing says there is one China, and Taiwan is part of it. Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
Less than a month after a new administration took the helm at the White House, the United States and China still seem to be at each other's throats. The new U.S. Secretary of State, during the Senate confirmation hearing, was one of the first Biden administration officials to have tough words for China.
My view is we have an abiding and longstanding and bipartisan commitment to Taiwan and to the Taiwan Relations Act. We need to make sure that they have the means to deter aggression, to defend themselves. I'd like to see them, Taiwan even more engaged in the world.
On Friday, the new White House National Security Advisor echoed the top diplomat's words about Beijing.
And then the last piece is speaking with clarity and consistency on these issues and being prepared to act as well to impose costs for the what China is doing in Xinjiang, what it's doing in Hong Kong, for the bellicosity of threats that it is projecting towards Taiwan.
While the United States does not officially recognize the independence of Taiwan, it has extensive ties with the island and has promised its support in case of a military showdown with mainland China. Beijing has time and again warned Washington to refrain from ties with Taiwan. China and the United States are also at odds over the South China Sea. Beijing claims the energy-rich waters almost in its entirety, but countries such as the Philippines and Vietnam lay overlapping claims. Washington has promised to stand with those Southeast Asian claimants. But the tensions between the two countries do not stop here. China and the United States have also been engaged in a bitter and costly economic rivalry. The trade war reached a peak under the former U.S. president. During Trump's term, China and the United States imposed tit-for-tat tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods. Now all eyes are waiting to see how the ties between the world's two biggest economies would develop. Will tensions cool with a new president at the White House, or will the war of words continue and possibly get even worse? Only time can tell.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin, Frank Imsbach, out of Madison, a Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, George Simply, out of Budapest. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Madison. Your take on this, why are we seeing such aggressive words so early on from the Biden administration against China?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the overall framework. Talking about a framework in regards to Taiwan that was announced in 1949 when the Chinese communists at that point had won the Civil War. A remnant had retreated of the right wing, retreated to Taiwan. And so that issue was the Cold War issue, you know, who lost China? And we have never moved off of that model. So this is 80 years later or whatever. So the whole framework doesn't make any sense anymore in that regard. In terms of the most immediate thing, the Democrats have always felt on the defensive about China since 1948, when they were charged with losing China, you know. And so they have always been had this sort of reaction. Plus, there's a deep-seated, and I think somewhat hidden, but deep-seated anti-Chinese bias here from 1880. You know, so what is the situation now? The situation now, for the first time in 150 years, is that the United States may no longer be the top dog. You know, China's a big place. There's a lot of people there. There's a lot of things going on technologically. And so I think these types of deep-seated feelings, the notion of being maybe pushed out of the top perch, all feed into this.
Okay. What about that, George? Let me get George in on this conversation. George, what about that, what Frank has just said? Is that the main problem as far as relations between China and the United States, is that basically China is in the process of overtaking the United States as the largest economy, and also from a technological perspective, many say that actually Beijing will overtake the United States very soon. Your take?
I think so. And historically, there's no question that great powers do not cede their place to an upcoming rival power peacefully. That has always been the case. We remember what happened with when Germany emerged as the great power towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. And something like that is happening today. It's not just that China is overtaking the United States in terms of the size of its economy, but that China is exerting its influence in the world and using its economic and financial power to exert its influence and creating alternative economic models to the Washington consensus. So when it comes to things like the Belt and Road Initiative, and whereby it's investing in other countries are now finding China as being a rather more attractive economic partner than that of the United States, because for one thing, China interferes much less in the internal affairs of other countries than does the United States. So well, that's been the case hitherto. So what's happened now is that not only has China overtaken the United States and is exerting its economic influence and it's creating an alternative reserve currency, an alternative financial and banking system, but it has a very close ally with Russia, which, though not an economic giant by any means, has a very substantial strategic arsenal and seems to have overtaken, for the first time since the end of World War II, seems to have overtaken the United States in terms of its strategic nuclear arsenal. So when you combine that together, this is causing a great deal of anxiety in Washington. And as I said, historically, great powers react with violence when they find that their position has been pushed aside.
What about that, Frank? Do you agree with George? And if you do, what type of scenario does that set up in general?
First, in today's Wall Street Journal, there's a number of articles about General Motors agreeing to or announcing they're going to be making all electric cars in 2035. The article goes on to state that essentially we're following the Chinese model. The Chinese, through their organization of the car industry at this point, as the largest single market in the world, are essentially going to be calling the shots. Now, think about that in terms of global power. The automobile, the United States, all that symbolism, what that means. So that was the Wall Street Journal's estimate, so to back up what my colleague in Budapest said. In terms of the future, nuclear war is unthinkable. That's the one, that's the problem here. And so if you continue to stoke this without figuring out alternative means of settling this problem, we're done as a human race. And mm-hmm. I think some recognition of that. But I think that we, as normal people, have to begin to say, moving down this path, in spite of history, is the wrong way to go, because it's going to lead to nothing. It's going to lead to destruction. And I think we really need to begin to say that.
Okay.
To people.
Well, wouldn't it be, George, wouldn't it be more beneficial for both countries and the world if the U.S. and China work together? Of course, we understand the rivalry, but basically, I mean, if we look at the situation, we look at, for example, the United States is the largest consumer economy, country, and of course, China is the largest manufacturer. So there's a symbiotic relationship that they actually need each other. What do you think it will take to have them, instead of basically coming face to face with this conflict, being able to actually work better together? Is that a possibility?
Well, one would hope that that's a possibility. But there are a lot of economic issues that divide the two countries. And one of it is certainly unfair trading practices. I mean, the United States has, particularly under Trump, issued a whole series of demands upon the Chinese to engage in fairer trade practices. They've talked about, lack of access to the Chinese market. They've talked about intellectual property theft. And what's now, and this is emerged as a big issue, is of course also the virus. Because right in the last days of the Trump administration, I mean, they've accused China of, almost accused them of deliberately infecting the world with the virus. Now, even if the Biden people pull back on some of those accusations, they're not just going to go away just like that, because, first of all, one thing, this virus is a big, very big deal. I mean, if you lose, maybe 20-25% of your economy as a result of this pandemic, then you really want to say, we want to make sure that nothing like this happens again, and therefore, what exactly is China doing about addressing this issue to make sure that nothing like this happens again? And to be honest, China has failed to come up with any plausible explanation, so therefore, this is going to rankle for quite some time.
Frank, your take on that. What do you see as the main issues? Now, George has also talked about the pandemic itself. Your take on the main issues that really separate the U.S. and China?
I think it's the overall question of who's in charge. Clearly, there are individual economic issues, whether it's patents or battery production or who's got the lithium. And also, the virus adds a much greater complicating factor. It's easy for us to blame the Chinese. You know, that's a pretty simple thing. When in fact, there have been several viruses the last several years, most of them not coming from China. There's a whole development of agriculture, the way things are done, all of which lean towards that we're going to have more of this problem. So just to blame the Chinese scientifically doesn't make much sense. But politically, that's another story. And there, it did work for the Trump administration for a while. But I think, again, you're going to have some leadership here on the part, certainly, of my country, which I can speak about, and I hope in China, where people actually take a deep breath and step back and say, where can we work things out? Because going down the current pathway of saying, well, Taiwan really is independent, and we're going to defend it to the death. Well, who's death here? Mm-hmm. And what is going to happen? And I don't think that is a viable long-term pathway, either economically or politically.
Well, Frank, let me stay with you, because I want to talk about the American side in this. It is quite difficult for Americans not to see themselves as number one. Can the U.S. actually deal with that in a non-militaristic way, because so far what we see is the U.S. flexing its muscles. And basically, how did the U.S. get here? Because the U.S. had the largest economy. Technologically, the U.S. Was seen as number one. And what exactly happened to the United States in your perspective?
Well, we got here because of World War II, so to speak. I mean, when we're talking about the United States saying that we're on the defensive, when we have an aircraft carrier parked outside of China and another one parked outside of your country, and that's our defensive perimeter, and anybody that fools with that is the aggressor, well, that's quite a stretch, you know, 3,000 miles away, and we take the position that this is okay, that we have the right to be in the Western Pacific and the Gulf and so forth. So it's going to take quite a bit of rethinking here, and it's not clear to me that there are the forces available or mobilized to begin that rethinking. So I think this is a very dangerous situation. What we're left with are people with great economic interest in not having a war with China. And I think that's a very important thing, but I'm not sure it's sufficient.
What about you, George? What do you think as far as rethinking it? Do you think that the United States, first of all, is ready to rethink their policy? Now, Frank talked about post-World War II and how the perimeters continue to expand as far as the United States and its interests. Basically, did the United States wound itself by putting so much emphasis on the military, or your assessment of the situation?
Well, military power is, of course, a key to U.S. power in the world, but, of course, in other aspect of it was through the use of the dollar as the reserve currency. I mean, it was able to coerce countries through its dominance of the dollar. With China, although it doesn't really equal the United States as a military power, nonetheless, in terms of its financial power, it will indeed very soon be able to challenge the dollar. And unfortunately, the United States hasn't used its power with the dollar as intelligently as it should have done. And that's why I think many countries will be very happy to see an alternative to the dollar. But when it comes to military power, I think that what the United States is trying to do is using its economic, its military muscle in order to coerce China to make concessions, to make economic and financial concessions. So I think that that's, I think, the role. So why is China, the United States, bringing up issues like Taiwan and Hong Kong and the treatment of the Uyghurs? You know, they're all matters that are internal in China, and even the whole issue of what's going on in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. I mean, you know, these aren't really issues that affect United States security in any way, but they are being used by the Americans to coerce China. So in other words, you know, to get concessions out of them in other spheres, because I think that the United States wants to make sure that it retains its economic dominance. I mean, it's pretty sure about its military dominance, but it's economic dominance that is under challenge.
Well, Frank, with the U.S.'s descent from power, how aggressive do you see Washington becoming during this process?
Well, I'm not sure how aggressive it's going to become. Here's one of the problems. You have, in order to deal with China or the rest of the world, the United States is going to have to decide if we're interested in controlling investment and interested in what we call mobility of capital. China became the number one destination for foreign investment over the last quarter, for the first time ever, surpassing the United States. That's a big deal, because people are saying, well, invest there. The United States depends on foreign investment to maintain its economy and like every place else. So you begin to see that cannot be solved militarily. And that's a problem for the United States, because we put all of our eggs really in the military basket. And so that's one aspect of this. The other thing is, yes, the economic part. So far, the tariffs have cost the United States way more than they have cost the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So that didn't work out so well. And I think that, you know, there are the to go down the road of conflict here, both economic and military, is not going to yield a solution that's positive for the United States or probably anybody else.